Hello and welcome to the NHRA Insider Podcast powered by Speedmaster.
At the eighth mile, she's leading Bo Butner at the finish line stripe. It's Cameron Caruso for the first time, 6.592.
On this episode, we're joined by four-time NHRA Top Fuel champion Steve Torrence and five-time Pro Stock champ Jed Coughlin.
And there goes Gage Herrera. Vinny, Vidi, Vici. He came, he saw, he conquered.
We'll be talking all things NHRA Lucas Oil Winter Nationals.
Chad Green's out first by a bunch. They get to the finish line stripe, and it's Chad Green. 391.6 on a whole shot, a 33 line.
This is the NHRA Insider powered by Speedmaster.
Into the night they go, and the wind light comes on for Doug Collada. 367.3, 334 miles an hour.
Hey, everybody. Brian Loans here, the NHRA Insider Podcast, powered by Speedmaster. It is our Lucas Oil NHRA Winter Nationals episode. And as mentioned, a couple of champions, multi-time champions coming on, a four-time Top Fuel World Champion and an alcohol dragster champion, Steve Torrence. That's five world championships for him. And six-time world champion, once in Super Gas, five times in Pro Stock, Jed Coughlin will be the second guest on this show. Jeggy and Steve, two guys that I love catching up with. They're cerebral. We're going to get into some of the mental aspects of drag racing and try to take this conversation to the next level. Speaking of next level, Speedmaster, the official presenting sponsor of the NHRA Insider Podcast, is next level when it comes to the parts you need for your ride, whether it's mild, whether it's wild, whether it's street and strip, whether it's a Top Fuel dragster. They have everything you could possibly need. Ford, Chevrolet, Mopar, and more. You can find them online at speedmaster79.com. Everything from cylinder heads, camshafts, blocks, connecting rods, pistons, you name it, they have it. Dress-up parts, small items, all the things you want and need, from fasteners to Top Fuel parts. They have it in stock. Check out Speedmaster79.com and get a look at all their lineup. We're powered by Speedmaster. You should be too. This coming weekend, Lucas Oil NHRA Winter Nationals. Get your tickets on NHRA.com if you've not already. A lot of coverage this weekend coming on FS1, whether it's qualifying on Saturday and, of course, qualifying on Sunday in the elimination shows. We have Mission Too Fast, Too Tasty Challenge action for the first time this year. Always great to see that. That'll be, of course, in Top Fuel, Funny Car, and Pro Stock, as the motorcycles will rejoin us when we get back to the East Coast. We got some stuff to talk about here. The biggest news of the week so far, the announcement that Jasmine Salinas will take the seat of the Scrappers Top Fuel Dragster in Pomona, California for the Lucas Oil Winter Nationals, citing health reasons for Mike Salinas. She's replacing her dad in that car. As I do not have the information, nor has it been released as to what the health conditions are, we will not speculate. And when Mike and the Salinas family are willing, ready, and able to tell us, if that day arrives, we'll have that information then. But understand, certainly want the best for Mike Salinas and hope whatever has occurred comes with it a speedy recovery and that things are okay. Certainly not the way Jasmine had planned to get in the seat. She said as much in a press release that came out this week prior to the race. But for us as a sport, it is the introduction of another new face into Top Fuel. And the way that the release was written, the way that things came out, it was not necessarily stated that this would be the only race she'd be in the seat for. We understood she was going to make a debut this year, did not necessarily know when that was going to occur, but she is being put into service as a licensed Top Fuel driver. She is being put into service of that car this week. Obviously, everything remains the same with Rob Flynn, the Cave Brothers, and the capable crew that works on that car, including Troy Fashing, that will be tuning it. It ran well in Gainesville. Don't expect anything less in Pomona. Let's talk about what the conditions are looking like in Pomona, California for this weekend. It is going to be sunny Southern California weather. It is going to feel like maybe sunny April weather in Detroit. High of 61 on one day, high of 63 on Sunday, a high of 70 on Friday. It is going to be very fast. And I'm talking real fast. I'm talking Bob to have the wagon loaded type of fast. We know what number we want to see on a scoreboard. And I feel like that the Ford Motorcraft Mustang, which will be wearing a really killer new Mustang kind of dark horse livery on it this weekend, may be primed and ready to deliver. The performances we saw at Top Fuel at a very graciously atmosphered Gainesville, let's call it, when it wasn't raining, 335, 337 mile an hour runs, big speeds out of Top Fuel dragsters. We expect to see more of the same in Pomona. We know how good the racetrack is there. We know it goes downhill. We know it is ridiculously fast. Another piece of positive news from Pomona, kind of internally, is that we're going to see a bigger crowd than we've seen there in years. The Winter Nationals continues to regain momentum in terms of the drag racing fan base in Southern California, and that is something I think all of us are thankful for. In-N-Out Burger Pomona Drag Strip will be buzzing. The burger trucks will be slinging food, and the fans will be coming in numbers we haven't seen in years, and that's always a great thing. It's a place that, of course, birthed the sport of drag racing in Southern California, the crucible where it came from, and we always want to have a great presence there. So other things maybe to catch up on, and we know that Travis Shoemake will be making his debut when we get to Arizona. Gerda June will be the crew chief on that car. Lex and Gerda have been working with Travis and the crew they have to get the car final preparations done. He released a rendering with his sponsors on it, Arizona Lottery, Fry's. He's got some great names on that car. He sent me a picture of the car. I said, it looks like a bomb pop. You got red, white, and blue on there. A nitro-powered bomb pop. Either way, he'll be making his debut in Arizona. We'll talk more about that next week when we start to kind of look forward to that race. But, you know, it's so early in the season. There's no time or really inclination to start making predictions about anything now in terms of what the implications are for a race like we're about to have at the Lucas Oil Winter Nationals. But what we can say is that we're going to really start to see teams maybe tip their hand performance-wise because they're not going to have a choice. We have full fields in all professional categories, 21 pro stock cars, which is going to be the theme of this season. And, you know, there are a couple of cars that you could look at the Gainesville list and think, you know what, these two or three might be a bit of a long shot to make the field. Now we look at this list, we see 21 cars here, and there is not one car of the 21 that I look at and think, oop, no shot here. Whether it's a young driver that has good power, whether it's an experienced driver that has Metz power, these are all cars that are full-on, pro-level, basically full-time pro stock cars. And so when we see 21 of them on a sheet and you try to grade them 1 through 21, you end up with a lot of 15s and 16s. And so those 15s and 16s can't all exist in those two spots. So that's what's going to be the drama in pro stock this weekend, is watching that qualifying process. And I'm interested to talk to Jake Coughlin about the evolution of the pro stock category in terms of the driver, in terms of the approach, in terms of what is important now that maybe was less important when he started in the late 90s, early 2000s, or are some of the things he did then still as important to his team, as cogent to his success as what he's doing now? So all that stuff we're going to catch up with. And, of course, Steve Torrence, I love talking to Steve. We're going to touch on a lot of different topics with him. He's always a great chat to kind of get involved with. Krista Baldwin, going to be a great story here at these Winter Nationals. She has purchased, and this is some time ago, right at the beginning of the year, she purchased Pat Dakin's entire Top Fuel operation. With it comes crew chief Scott Graham, comes with a lot of experienced crew people, and comes with, I think, her own increased expectations of performance and success. You have to remember, the car that she retired, the car that she effectively gave back to her grandfather, Chris Karamasinas, was DSR chassis 001. It was the very first dragster production chassis DSR made. It was, without a shadow of a doubt, the oldest Top Fuel car that was out in competition. Of course, it was legal and had been updated over the course of years, but still was a very, very old car. So with this new equipment, with people that have absolutely been tuning this equipment for years, it is applying what they already know to the car they know. It is not applying what they know to a car that's not going to respond a different way. So Krista Baldwin will certainly be someone to watch, and it's great to have her picking up the tour this early. I believe she's going to run all three of the Pomona, Phoenix, Las Vegas races. Funny car, we have the largest field of funny cars in a decade at Pomona. And I didn't just get choked up when I said it. I don't know what just happened to my throat. But we have the largest field in a decade. That was not me getting emotional over 21 funny cars. Maybe it is. I don't know. But this is a great thing. We have a great set of independent funny cars on the West Coast. They're all coming. Alex Milodinovic is coming back. Even Jim Campbell and the Hirschhauser Racing Team making the tow all the way to Pomona. So we're going to see a battle for funny car qualifying at the Winter Nationals, the likes of which we have not seen since 2014. And that is going to be awesome. We've never had an all 3 second funny car field, kids. Is this the weekend with these 21 cars that we finally get there? If not, is it a weekend we set a record bump spot? These are all questions that will be answered by the time we conclude on Saturday afternoon. There are a myriad of things to be excited about for this weekend. I could go on for days, but a couple of high points here. If you're coming out to the race, we're going to be making an NHRA Insider Podcast Live powered by Speedmaster on Saturday morning. We'd love to see you out there. We're going to be shooting that baby about 8:30. Bright and early, get to the racetrack. You can come hang out with us. We got great guests coming on. We got young pro stock racers coming on. We got J.R. Todd and Sean Langdon coming on. Me and Tony Pedregon will be hosting and kind of talking ourselves through this weekend, catching up on stories and any of the scuttlebutt we hear in the pits. So make sure you get there. If you're coming to the race, be a part of the show live. Bring a sign. I want people showing up with this show with signs. We're going to bang on that all year long. Want to build that great kind of game day environment around the whole thing, so I want you to be a part of that. Like I said, I go on for days, but I'm not going to. I'm going to get us to our first guest when we come back on the NHRA Insider Podcast, powered by Speedmaster. It will be Steve Torrence. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to the NHRA Insider Podcast, powered by Speedmaster. On the line right now, four-time NHRA Top Fuel World Champion and teammate to his pop full-time this year, Billy Torrence. I have Steve Torrence on the line. What's going on, man?
Hey, Brian, how you doing, man? Good to have you on, or good to be with you.
Yeah, hey, good. I'm on your show. That's how this is going right now.
Yeah, good to have you on my show.
So, man, let's talk a little bit about the Gator Nationals before we get into Pomona. And, you know, you mentioned something early on in the weekend, and you're like, it finally seems to be working, and the numbers bear it out. I mean, this was a car that lived in that mid-330-mile-an-hour range or better all weekend, runs in the 60s, qualified well. It does seem to be the fruits of the labor seem to be finally paying off.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, it's crazy how well the car did. My dad, I told him, I said, you just got lucky because we're really going to outrun you real bad and on the tire. And then I told Richard, I said, Hoagie, I'm not positive, but I think this thing may have smoked the tires when you started it. It didn't move. He said, well, it's early in the season, so I'm going to go ahead and agree with you. But, no, it was a great race car all weekend from, you know, first rattle out of the box and go out there. And then I think one of the sessions we were quick. My dad was second quickest, and we were like 700ths faster than him.
Yeah.
So it's got a lot of promise. There's still a little bit of fine tuning, but I feel really confident in what Richard and Bobby are doing. And the car is probably one of the baddest hot rods I've driven in, if not ever, you know, in a long time, if not ever. And so I'm pretty excited about it. And it looks, I mean, things are looking positive now. It may fall apart this weekend, but right now it'll be good.
Well, look, and the reality is this is kind of where you need to be these days in Top Fuel to compete. I mean, there was a time and place when if you had a car that could run, you know, 368 to 372 and the conditions were good, you were kind of in the game. But let's be honest, this year and even last year, if you don't have a car that can run a mid 60 when the conditions dictate it, you're kind of up to creek.
Yeah, at worst is a mid 60, you know, yeah. 66, 65, but we saw at Dallas last year, you go 63, yeah. 64, yeah. You know. So, and people don't realize, you know, the difference from a 66 to a 64 is huge. It's taken us some time to kind of get on that. I think the 63 that we ran last year was the quickest run in a few years.
Yes.
You know, so where we're at in going out there and running mid-60s and mid to low-60s is you have to hit the nail on the head with every aspect. I mean, you can't miss anything, or it doesn't do it, or it smokes the tires.
Yeah, and double down on that is, you know, we look around and the quality of the cars obviously continues to kind of raise each and every year. And, you know, we got new faces coming into the category. We got, you know, faces we know and different equipment. And it's always kind of a moving target. But the one thing I took away from Gainesville And certainly with your program, both with your car and your father's, because he was down there, what, 66, I think he ran maybe in the first round of eliminations, was, you know, was a level that you can leave that racetrack understanding that we can stand in the ring with these guys. Like, the there's no lingering doubt that you can run with the front of the pack.
Well, I, you know, I mean, without being a little overconfident, I think that we can be, we are the front of the pack.
Yeah.
There's just a couple cars that can run that quicker. And, you know, it's dictated by the time you run,
sure,
the track conditions and everything. You know, that 65 was a few pairs earlier, and we all know that when you run early in the morning or you know, first round, the front of the pack has a different racetrack completely than the back of the pack.
Yes.
So, but one thing that made me the most proud was Billy went 66.9, we went 67.2. I mean, that was pretty much two identical runs. And that's difficult to have two cars that run so closely together. And that's where you benefit.
You know, one of the things whether you want to go into it or not is fine, but what was the impetus for your dad for this year to say, you know what, I'm going to do the full pull? What was the kind of, what was maybe the behind the scenes conversation on that the decision got made?
I guess you've known Billy long enough to kind of know how he is, and he just said, I'm going racing. I said, okay, and you also know Billy well enough to, you know, just, he beats to his own drum, and
yeah,
we follow along. And so whatever he desires, we do, we make it happen. And so that's a lot of hard work from everybody there at the race team and all those guys coming together to make it happen. And I'm excited, and I'm happy that he's out there.
And look, it, there's no reason to think that this doesn't make you even stronger. I mean, you got Jason McCulloch on that car, Joe Barlam. I mean, these are two very experienced championship-level guys who now are a full-time part of what's going on. And as we all know out here in 2024 in professional drag racing, the more brain power, the better sometimes, or maybe most of the time.
Yeah, you got to have somewhat of a brain trust, you know.
Yeah.
and anymore, there's not one crew chief, there's a couple guys up there, because there's so much that has to be just spot on, you know, and the calls and the track and just making changes. I mean, you see a lot of that going on, and it's just, I'm not saying one guy can't do it, but it's just a lot easier with two.
Yeah, and look, one of the things I'm interested in too is the guys that I think are most closely aligned with your dad, the fan base your dad has, is the hardworking dude that puts on his boots every day and goes to work. I remember when he won Epping, he was thanking the lobsterman. He had some conversation with a fisherman, and he said that helped him win the race. And I think it's such a cool thing because, you know, your fan base obviously skews younger. You're a younger guy. But for him, I think he really connects with a hardcore blue-collar guy that comes to the races and wants to see him do well.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, I mean, that's what he is. That's what I am. We work hard every day to ensure that, you know, our family's taken care of.
Yep.
And then also we get to go out there and race and have a good time. That's what we enjoy to do. That's what we've done for years. And, you know, it's been a long time since I've been able to race with my dad. A few years back, he raced quite a bit of the schedule, but he's never raced full time. And so, it's, you know, it's just a different, we have a whole different, I would say, objective and goal of our race team. You know, it is a business, but it's also what we do as a family and as a hobby. And so, you know, some people lose sight of that, and some people don't understand it because, I mean, we just have a different, whole different program.
And that's why I think people look at your team differently than they look at other teams. And I think, like you said, the people that get it really get it, and the people that don't get it scratch their heads and wonder why. And that's not your problem, right? And that's not your problem to explain it.
No, and you're right. I mean, some people look at it like, why are you doing that? That's
right.
You could do a lot of other things than
right.
that. Yeah. Well, we enjoy to compete. We enjoy competing at that level, and you know, I aspired my whole life to be a top fuel driver. I never imagined, you know, the success that I've had in the past. And you look at it and you're thinking, man, I just want to drive one of those things. And then you get to drive one and you're like, well, I'd really like to win around.
Right.
And then you look around, you're like, I'd kind of see if we can win a race.
Right. You get jealous or you get greedy all of a sudden, right? Yeah.
Yeah, then you get greedy and you're like, well, heck, let's just win a championship and let's win another one. So my whole life I've competed in martial arts and motocross and drag racing and everything. And so it's, you know, you just keep going. You never really look up until you're done.
Yeah.
When you're done, you can look up and say, man, look what we did. But while you're in the middle of the bout, it's like fighting.
Yeah.
You can't think, man, that was a good punt.
You're right. You're laying on the canvas before you know it. If you start admiring your fists, you got a big problem. Yeah.
Yeah. That was a good punch, but you're followed by, you didn't take that one very well.
Right. So, if you watch that Anthony Joshua and Ngannou fight, you understand how that went down. The guy stumbled up forward, and Joshua just buried him with the right hand. So, yeah, it can end real quick.
Yeah.
So, let's look at Pomona. We got a weekend forecast that the high is going to be 70. It's looking like 61 to 62 degrees on Saturday and Sunday, which to me, if I'm sitting in Steve Torrence's seat right now, I kind of like it because – I wouldn't like it if I came out of Gainesville with a car that could only run 375, but that's not the car you're sitting in. So in reality, these are conditions that may play to your hand, maybe more so than they have over the last couple of seasons.
Yeah, I hadn't – that does kind of excite me. I hadn't looked at the weather yet. We've been pretty busy here at home. But I'm excited about that. That definitely, it'll be a different ball game. I mean, you go there and you're going to have to show up loaded for bear to throw down. And we now have that feather in our cap. I think that we can go out there and run as quicker than anybody. We just got to go execute. And, you know, this is the time of year that you gain that data and that knowledge and that tune up, and then you'll put it back on the shelf throughout the middle of the year. But you'll need it again at the end. And at the end is where you need to be able to go out and dominate. So we admittedly took a year and a half to figure this whole thing out and get it back to where it needed to be. But I think had we not, we wouldn't be as competitive now. The 4 years that we won the championship, not only were we quick, but we were very, very consistent, and that's something that we lost, but are working diligently to get back right now is not only being fast, but the consistency. And when you got to sacrifice something, and that's what we sacrificed to try to get quicker. And now the consistency's coming around just like we saw at Gainesville.
Well, one of the things, and I think it was Bob Taska that said it to me last year, and it struck me, and to reinforce the point you just made, he basically said the same thing you did, but he put it in more stark terms. He's like, if you get to the end of May and you don't have a car that can run with the pack and you go into the summer, you're screwed when it comes to the fall. And I never really thought of it that way, but he's 100% right. And you've just said the same thing that, yes, when we go to Dallas, obviously we typically get the La Land conditions. Vegas is certainly a place that can be a bit of a wild card, but the finals in Pomona, all these typically are races that really do favor that cool weather performance. And if you don't have it and you're trying to figure it out, then it's way too late.
Yeah. You need to be prepared by May to endure the summer and then come out swinging for the countdown. You know, you got to break the season into three parts. And, I've said it before. I'm not a fan of the countdown.
Sure.
Because of that, it's you're sampling, you're taking a 33% sample.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not indicative of what you did all year. And so, I mean, I'm not going to sit here and throw stones. It is what it is.
No, listen, hey, your opinion's as valid as anybody else's, and you're in the middle of it, so maybe even more valid than that. I'll take it.
You know, but you got to be able to go out there and throw down in those conditions. That's when you win a championship. That's when you do well. You know, it's very imperative that you can haul butt right now when it matters.
One of the questions I'm going to ask Jag later on in the show, and I want to ask you the same question, is why is this such a mental game? You know, it's like the noise, the tire smoke, the 330 miles an hour, all that stuff's great. But when it comes right down to it, this is such a mental freaking game. And why is that?
Well, I mean, we're being measured in thousands. You know, as a driver, you win or lose a thousandth of a second. And getting in there, I mean, it's a, you can easily become a basket case when you climb inside the bottom.
Right.
And say, hey, let's go. And I got to take off, you know, at this time and do this, which that's what we do. I mean, we're professionals at what we do, but you know, there's so many things that have to go right. There's so much effort that goes into one run in the car, whether it's pro stock, funny car, top fuel, or super comp or anything. There's so much preparation that culminates into seconds.
Yeah.
You know, and so mentally you have to be able to separate all of that, any outside influences, any stresses, any pressures, and get in the race car and be absolutely perfect. For us, you know, less than 4 seconds.
Yeah. Is that harder to do? Is it harder to do the longer you do it? Like, is that whole thing, like, you know, ignorance is bliss, they say, right? Like, when you're that young driver and you're in the car and maybe there's an intimidation factor, but you don't have all this stuff to think about. You know, are there times when the 4 championships weigh heavier on you than being a rookie did all those years ago?
Yeah, I think so. I do. I think that you pretty much rung the bell there when you say, when you get in that thing and you're a rookie and there's so much that you're thinking about that you're not really thinking about what you're doing. You know, you're just going up there and doing it, and it's easier when it's that. I think it's easier that way because maybe your concentration is a little more in tune of what you're doing.
Yeah,
and you are focusing on staging a car and doing, you know, doing whatever you do. And then as you get more comfortable, I think that there's some complacency or you emphasize, you know, cutting a light more than anything else you're doing. Yeah. And at the end of the day, you can overcomplicate all of this.
Sure.
I'm a prime example. I've done it myself, where you go up there all you got to do is drive the race car.
Right. Right. And on paper, it's real simple. Yeah.
Yeah. On paper, it's like the yellow light comes on and you hit the gate and drive it straight all the way to the end and pull the parachute. And sometimes you got to keep it simple. And I do that. I tell myself, just go drive the race car, Steve. You know what you're doing. And I think the more success you have, the more pressure you put on yourself to continue that success. I think that the more pressure people put on you unknowingly because they expect that success. And it's extremely difficult. I've had some troubles over the last couple of years because car's not as dominant.
Yep.
Confidence in the car isn't as high as it once was. So then you start putting a little pressure on yourself to do more or be more. And anytime you do that and back yourself into a corner, mentally, you typically, you know, make mistakes and do things that is out of character. And I was victim of it. I mean, I lost on some hole shots last year that ultimately cost me the championship. So, you've got to take that and you got to be able to move on and just, like I said, kind of block all that out and just go do what you do.
Yeah, you and I were both part of a great documentary that unfortunately has not seen the light of day to this point. It was made a couple of seasons ago now, but you related a fantastic story right at the start of this thing, and it was basically after your first full run at a top fuel car, and you got out of the thing at the top end, and you said to yourself, I don't even know if I want to do this anymore. To me, it was one of the great stories because, you know, how many people have had that same moment where you're like, okay, this is not exactly what I thought it was going to be. I mean, I think I might have liked it, but I don't know if I want to do it again.
Man, I that's one of the most clear memories I have of racing is the first pass I made in that car. And, you know, like you said, I remember getting out of that car and thinking, what the hell I set myself up for? And it was so fun, so intimidating, so just plain ass scary that I thought I might have bit off a little more than I can chew. I don't know if I want to get back in this thing. And I was getting out of a really fast A fuel dragster at the time, and I had built it up in my mind that it was going to be this monster, you know, this you're going to hit the gas, it's going to pull your head off and drag it with you, and then finally it'll reattach, and then you'll be able to shut the car off if you survive and all this. And so the first couple runs, it smoked the tires at like the 330, which I was so thankful. And I was thinking, wow, this isn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. And then I go out there and I made two runs. I made four runs that day and got my license. I made two tire smokers at like the 330, and then the next two runs were full pulls. And just about the 330 is where I thought, okay, this is terrible.
That's where the party starts, right? Yeah.
Because that's where everybody showed up to the party, and all eight of the cylinders said, hey, let's go to the end. And the tires held on, and I'm thinking, I think, okay, I've hit the gas. We've gone a couple hundred feet. It's not that bad. And then it really started going. It really started running right there at the 330, and I'm like, okay, this shit is terrible. It's going faster and faster. And this, I'm not going to let off the gas, but that finish line is coming really fast, and I'm glad. It's comical now, but I can't even tell you the amount of emotions that was going through my mind and just sheer confusion. And when that parachute came out, I was like, oh my God, it's over. I've lived through it. And like, funny story, my first race ever was Richmond. I got my license and we got everything prepared and set up, and I go to Richmond and I'm teammates with J.R. Todd, and this is back in the ESPN days. They're interviewing me and I'm nervous as heck, you know. I'm not gonna let anybody know that, but I'm basically scared to death. And I had just come out of an A-fuel car and won a championship and done well, you know.
Yeah.
And I know what's going on. I go down through there, and I'm almost certain it was the first full pass I made in competition.
Okay.
And I ran a 4-something. You know, this is in the days of the quarter mile.
Sure.
It was a 4-something. And it was quicker than anything I'd ever done. I throw the parachutes, and I'm thinking, damn, these parachutes are terrible. They're not working very good at all. I get out, and the parachutes have blown off. I mean, they're gone. And I don't know if it was that run or another run. I'm going down through there, the same race, and one of the body panels flies off, like the side body panel. It blew off. And I thought, self, I don't know if this is a good idea.
This might not be the best idea. Yeah.
I mean, I look back at a lot of that stuff now and just laugh, but I was so naive to think that the parachutes had blown off, and this thing was so fast that the parachutes just didn't even work that well. If I'm going 50 mile an hour faster than what I was, that the parachutes just feel like they're not there or what, but we're not stopping very good.
You don't know what you don't know, right?
You don't know what you don't know. And then I did know when the body panel blew off, because immediately I could see everything down there beside me going by, and I thought, we're going way too fast to be looking at the road.
Oh, man. You know, last thing I want to hit you up on is, you know, the whole you don't know what you don't know. One of the things you do know now is being a dad, and you're going to be a dad two times over. So congratulations on that. And how much are you looking forward to the next edition of the family?
Man, that's the best statement you can say, is you don't know what you don't know.
Yep.
Because I was nervous. I mean, that's a whole lot of uncertainty when that little baby comes out and they hand her to you or him to you, whatever. And it's like, okay, here you go.
Right.
You basically, it's kind of like buying something that you don't know anything about. It'd be like somebody handing you the keys to the space shuttle.
Yeah.
And no owner's manual or direction book or anything. They're like, hey, here you go. It's yours.
You know what? It's almost like your analogy about the 330 and the dragster. When you hold that baby for the first time, that's when all cylinders are lit at the 330.
Yes. And you're like, okay, well, this is mine now, and I got to take care of it. But like, you're not going to give me any instructions or
nothing.
No phone number to call if I got a question or anything. It's like, here you go. But man, it's the coolest thing ever. My little girl is the my world, and you know, I saw a meme here probably a year or so ago, and it means more today than it did a year ago. But it said, I never knew how much of an asshole I could be until I made a miniature version often live with it every day.
Right.
And my wife will be the first to tell you that the only thing that she brought to the equation was hair and height. Because my little girl's got a lot of hair, and she's kind of tall for her age. And the rest of it is full-blown Steve Torrance, because I look at her sometimes, and I'm like, where did you learn that? But it's all generic. And I'm looking so much forward we got another little girl that'll be here in June, and you got to enjoy it, because the time goes by so fast and they grow up so quick. I mean, my little girl's going to be 3 in a few weeks, and we're at the point now where we have conversations. I'm like, how was your day today? And what did you do? And she went to Disney last week and spent a couple of days out there, and that's been the highlight of her life so far. I mean, go out there and have dinner and breakfast with the princesses and you know, see Mickey and Minnie and all those. Like, that's been the highlight of her life to this point. And I've enjoyed just hearing the stories, because I didn't go. My wife and my mom and those guys went, but she'll fabricate some of the stories a little bit. She's like, well, I went there and Goofy was cooking cookies for me.
Right.
And I asked Nat, I go, was Goofy cooking cookies? She goes, no, there were no cookies. But if she wants to believe it, we're good with it. So
absolutely.
No, man, it's by far the coolest thing I've ever been able to experience, is being a dad. And I wanted a boy. God knew I needed a girl. And I wouldn't trade it for the whole world, because being a girl dad is pretty dadgum special, man. Especially in between those moments of her acting like Steve Torrance, she's really sweet. And when she curls up and sits in your lap and looks at it and you goes, hi, daddy. You know, there's nothing better than that.
Well, man, I appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to chat. It's always great to catch up with you, and certainly looking forward to what this season has in store for the Capco Contractors 2-car operation. Certainly a strong start, not the end result you wanted in Gainesville, but all the building blocks for success are there. And pack a jacket. It's going to be cool this weekend.
Hey, absolutely. I'm excited about it. I'm looking forward to being there, and we're probably going to have to bring a couple jackets, because, yeah, it hadn't been – it was 38 this morning at home, and man, that was like, it was like 80 yesterday. So I'm not a cold weather guy. I don't like the cold.
He's Steve Torrance, 4-time Top Fuel champion of the world. We'll be back in just a minute here in the NHRA Insider, powered by Speedmaster, with Jay Coughlin Jr. is coming up next. Don't go anywhere. Hey, everybody, welcome back to this episode of the NHRA Insider Podcast, powered by Speedmaster. I have our second guest on this show today. He is the man who is a 6-time NHRA World Champion, 5 times in Pro Stock, 1 time in Super Gas. He's won from every possible qualifying position, of course. I'm speaking about Jay Coughlin Jr. How you doing, man?
I'm doing great, Brian. How are you doing today?
I'm doing really well. Great to catch up with you here, and certainly great to have you back as a full-time member of the Traveling Acceleration Show in 2024.
It's good to be back, and what a way to put it. Life on the NHRA is extremely fast, and very quick. So love being back, and I love being on the show today.
You know, one of the things I wanted to talk to you about first is you know, in my job, I try to identify patterns. You know, I look at racers, and the numbers sometimes tell me things, and sometimes just watching and observing tells me things. But one of the patterns I'm trying to figure out with you, and it's a good one, is what are the determining factors for you over the course of your career, when you've decided to take a break, when you've decided to step away? And, you know, I'm kind of interested in the mechanics behind that. Not the fact that you've been able to pick it up and put it back down again, but you've been able to do this in a way that I think is probably good for your life and good for your family. And I'm just wondering what the driving kind of decision-making process has been in those times.
That would be like an As the World Turns episode. No, not quite. No, you know, it's been interesting, to say the least. You know, getting into pro stock in the late 1990s, in kind of the one of the heydays of the class, was really fun and enjoying. And you know, my first kind of gap year, if you will, was 2006. We kind of transitioned out of owning our own teams at the time, and I ran a year with Don Schumacher, led by Bob Clinton, which was quite a treat, frankly. And but at the conclusion of 05, as 05 was coming to a close, I knew that I had some things ahead of me that needed some attention off the racetrack. So I elected to step away from it. And if I came back to it, great. And if not, that's great too. And that's been my mindset, quite honestly, in a couple of the kind of gap years that I've had, with 06, I think maybe 2012. Was another one, and then again in 2015.
Yeah, and to me it's interesting because you're not the only guy that's ever done this. I mean, guys like Don Garless did this over the course of their career, and it was like, and I think it ultimately extended his ability to continue to compete and extended his ability to continue to enjoy what he did. I think, you know, there are some people that think once you step off the train, you never get back on the train again, and I'm not sure that's the kind of healthiest way to look at stuff.
Right. And I would agree with that statement. And pretty cool to be alongside with comments of the like of Big. So, you know, he's been so instrumental to the sport in many, many ways. And obviously with the museum today is still preserving the sport in a neat fashion. So, I can say that, you know, as I've had those years, I've certainly still been racing, but on a much more elective schedule basis. You know, there's no hidden secret. Bracket racing's always been a first love of mine.
Sure.
And there's no question it's some of the most cutthroat racing, and some of the best racers in the world are participating weekly, week in and week out at a lot of the NHRA sanctioned tracks around the country. And, you know, that has kept me sharp in those years that I've been away. And in this latest return, you know, it was kind of fueled by the opportunity to come out and drive. I'd been offered in previous years to do this since 2020, but elected to steer away from it. But this year had some, you know, intriguing points to it. And, you know, it was a new car for Erica to come out and wanted to test it in the real world. And so after 3 years of not being behind a pro stock car, I didn't miss too many runs of Troy Jr.'s since he stepped behind the wheel of the Jakes.com machine in 2021 full time. And he and I have had a lot of dialogue back and forth, which has been fantastic. So I've been a big fan of the sport, even though I wasn't physically there. You know, watched a lot of the NHRA.TV shows and enjoyed that. So as Cole Trickle would say, the coverage is excellent. So, it really was. I was able to help with a few things along the way and be a small part. But fast forward to the conclusion of 23, made a few runs in Tulsa, came back and ran Vegas and Pomona, and really felt like I had a renewed drive to consider a full-on assault. And you know, the folks from Skag Power Equipment elected to step in with Elite Motorsports to put a new program together, and as they'd say, the rest is history. And you know, we're getting ready to enter our second race of the NHRA Mission Foods Championship season, and couldn't be more energized. And you know, the first race was good. I can't complain whatsoever. Gainesville's always been one of my favorite events.
Sure.
In our lifetime, it's been the first big event on the East Coast. Now it's the first big event period right. of the NHRA season. Yeah. So you know, it's always one of those races you want to shine at. And unfortunately, you know, we weren't able to do that in fashion as we'd like. But, you know, we move on and we learn from it. And here we are rolling into Pomona, ready to go.
You know, I think one of the things Pro Stock needs, maybe beyond even other categories, is car count, right? And we've finally got that back. And, sure. You know, I look at an entry list at Gainesville that had 23 cars. I look at an entry list in Pomona that has 21 cars. And, you know, we've kind of beaten the story to death over the years. But, you know, it went from a class that was struggling, as other classes have in the course of time, and now a class that's very resurgent. And, no. You know, when I look at it, and this is, I mean, I guess this is more reminiscent of when you began your Pro Stock career. We have youth in the class. We have great experience like you. And now we got 20 plus cars showing up and you got to work to qualify.
Yeah, no doubt. You know, I've told the story several times. You know, it could be in the late 90s, early 2000s. You make the first session, you're qualified 1, 2, 3, 4, wherever you ended up. And by the time you run Q2, you know, the night is starting to set in. It's English Town. It's quick. It's fast. And, you know, you go from number 2 qualifier to number 6 qualifier. And by the time you're in the water box, you're like number 24, 25.
Right.
So it's real quick made you had to grow nerves of steel, so to speak. And I see that much in today's environment as well. And it's exciting. I think, you know, the competition level right now is extremely great from a performance standpoint. And when you look at the talent from behind the wheels throughout the multiple teams that are out there, you know, it's going to be a fun-filled season.
You know, I think we're at an interesting time in NHRA history. We obviously saw the Gainesville winners. All four of them were former junior dragster kids that came up and made their way into the professional ranks. And we have this moment in time that's not going to last forever. And that moment in time is guys like you that didn't have the opportunity to race juniors, that did it the old-fashioned way through foot brake bracket racing and coming up through that way, versus these kids that have learned a skill set when they're 7, 8 years old that you might have picked up when you were 15 or 16. Do you think you would have been, and this is almost an impossible question, but do you think you would have been an even better racer than you have been given the opportunity to have started in junior dragsters?
You know, it's only an answer we can say that we'll never know, but you know my learning curve was, you know, riding in the dually and riding in the you right. know the hollers with my brothers or my family or the racers like Steve Cohen, and you know, listening and learning and just grasping on to different theories of racing, and in this case more superclass and bracket racing in the later years of my youth. You know, yes, there's no question a lot of the youngsters starting at age 5 and starting to compete at, I think they can compete at age 7 and 8 now, you know, side by side. It is definitely giving them repetition and giving them an opportunity to build a good program and a good procedure around drag racing as it is. And I've seen a lot of these kids that I used to sign the autographs for, right. the ropes and the in the early 2000s, come out and be really brilliant racers. And I think the junior program certainly not only helped shape that career path for them, but obviously gave them the fundamental skills and competitive side to compete. Naturally, not everyone is the same. And, you know, that's why, you know, we have so many different classes in the NHRA, and that's one of our strong suits.
One of the elements that tends to get lost, I think, in the noise and in the tire smoke and in the screaming engines is the mental, really, acuity you need to have in this sport. And I'm wondering, you know, on a great race weekend, on a weekend when you're holding a Wally at the end of a race, or you're holding a championship Wally as you've done a half a dozen times in your life at the end of a season, is the pride in the execution? Is the pride in the mental preparedness? I kind of want to talk about that element, because somebody who has had the level of success you have had, you got to have both elements of it. So talk to me about why this is such a tough mental game to be good at.
Well, it certainly is, without question. I think what is, and those are questions that I'm talking to myself about as we speak, you know, as I'm trying to step my game up and roll into the second race of the year. And I think that hits the nail on the head. And that is, you know, you must give the respect of what is needed to, you know, compete for a round win or perhaps ultimately a race win, and then penultimately the season-ending championship. So that discipline and focus and preparation leading into such runs and or races is extremely important, and I think that's something that that I've kind of become a little lazy with in the last several years on tour, and even as I've brought myself back in, I'm really finding ways of reminder to myself on how to, you know, be competitive, be focused, and be disciplined. Those were always strong suits that I held from day one in the early 90s, late 80s when I started racing. But and I've been asked by dozens of racers, and many of them current even in the class, on different ways to compete and win, and here recently you know, I'm like, hey, as I'm preaching at the same time, because you know, this is a competitive game, and yeah, it's tough, and then you wrap all that around, that you need 110% out of that.
Yeah.
Now you need a team and a car and a competitive side coming out of the race car side of it, and with the engineers and crew chiefs, and when you get all that working together, then obviously you've got something to work with, and something that can turn some wind lights on and win some races. And I feel like we are in that position coming into Pomona and beyond. So it's, for me, it's not only exciting, but I'm looking forward to the challenges and hopefully the rewards that are in mind.
You know, one of the things I think is interesting, and you mentioned the fact that, you know, other racers have come to you for counsel, and rightfully, I mean, with your level of success. It seems to me, you know, as I was a kid at home watching in the early 2000s and paying attention to pro stock, and now I look at it in a more detailed view in my own job, it seems to me almost a totally different class in that, like you mentioned, in Englishtown, you can be second or third, you come back to qualifying session two, you're 23rd. We don't necessarily live in that world today, but we do live in a world where those questions you're being asked by racers are almost the same conversations that maybe crew chiefs would have had with each other years ago. Like, hey man, like, what did you do with the four link here? Versus, hey man, how do you approach this particular situation? Right? Is the crux of pro stock a lot more in the driver's seat than it ever has been?
I would say yes. I would say that is becoming more so. I think, as you just mentioned, you know, in the late 90s when we had, you know, 30 cars at a race, you had a good solid 15 to 16 different teams and different personalities and different mindsets tuning the cars. And today we've, you know, got maybe five or six teams. And what that means is, you know, a lot of this cross-pollination of you know, tribal knowledge of how to run a pro stock car has become more spread over more cars with the larger team sizes and whatnot. But so that's why I think your comment is becoming not more of a driver's race. I won't say that, but it's certainly an element as more of the cars are running much closer run after run after run because of the data that's going down the track every run. The crew chiefs are sharp. They do have the data, and they are making good, sound decisions, not to mention majority of them have been doing this since, you know, the 90s. So we've got some great gifted crew chiefs and engineers within the post-op pits, and it's showing in the level of competition, not only first round, but second round, third round, and naturally into the championship round. So, and that's what makes it exciting. I mean, pro stock's, you know, been dubbed, you know, door handle to door handle racing since as long as I can remember.
Yeah.
And we are seeing much, much more of that. And perhaps maybe you'll even see, you know, some more gamesmanship unfold.
Sure.
To try and gain different advantages. 100th year or 100th there to turn on some wind lights.
You know, you were one of the first teams back in the early days that allowed us, the fan, into the race car and really one of the most intimate ways you can, which is you guys were allowing us to hear crew radios back in the day when like nobody else was allowing us to hear that stuff. And the ESPN would always go to it, and it was always cool because, you know, it'd be like, oh, you got them by this much, or good job guys. Or you'd like immediately relay data back over the radio. Like, hey, it felt good here. It was a little loose here. Is that still part of the program? And I don't mean us listening to the radios, but I mean that level of immediacy in the communication.
It is, yes. I mean, wearing mouth guards now makes right. the transmission side of it be a little more garbled, if you will.
Yeah.
But you know, case in point, round one, I think it was round. Well, I know it was one of the qualifying rounds at Gainesville, and then round one again. I was one of the earlier pairs out, and my point back to Jake Hairston and Mark Ingersoll and Tim Freeman was, hey, you know, this is what the car felt like. Felt like it was definitely yearning for more down low. I know we've got a lot of cars behind us that are set up accordingly. So let's get after it. I've given some feedback similar to that already in 2024, and has that gone on to help us any? They're very sharp at watching the car and seeing the attitude of the car, and maybe just some of the feedback helps them reassure a thought or something in mind, and then tuning up the next ride that could be in the water box or could be a couple pair back.
Well, to your point, and this is an interesting point to make, and it kind of dovetails into what you talked about before, when yes, we're in an era where we talk about 5 to 6 major teams fielding a lot of these cars, and you have to go back to the pits to physically download the data to let the car tell you what it wants to tell you. But you being able to tell them, if you don't relate that information, they don't know it until they plug the plug the laptop in. So that's kind of an interesting development, actually. Maybe it's even more important now.
Well, it certainly doesn't hurt. Information is always good, and the better the information, of course, the better. My father, Jig, who was our crew chief on the pro stock side for a number of years, was always very interested in hearing the feedback.
Yeah.
And so I learned it at a young age in my pro stock career that I would give him the feedback immediately. And as it was as fresh as it could be in my mind, maybe that would have more value to it. And, as you fast forward through many years of racing together, he and I, sometimes our race pack didn't work for one reason or another. And, he'd ask me what I feel, what I hear, any kind of sensory upload that I could give. And then furthermore, he'd have me draw what I felt like the RPM graph looked like, what the drive shaft graph looked like, and what the clutch graph looked like.
Wow.
And a lot of times, he would take that information. We won the Spring Nationals in, the late 90s, and two of the four rounds we didn't have race pack data. So we went through that exercise and ended up winning the race. And not to add further chuckle, but I raced with the Elite in Drew Skillman's car out in Sonoma in Seattle in 2015 during one of my famous gap years. And in this car, you had to manually turn the computer on. And I, for some reason, on Q2, the night session, I didn't turn it on. And I gave him some feedback, and I did the old school. I just wrote it out. And I got a lot of kind of wows and chuckles and whatever you want to call it, any adjective you want to fill in there. And then I got a phone call about 10 o'clock that night from Jake Hairston, one of our crew chiefs and lead tuners at Elite. And he's like, after I got to laying in bed, I got to thinking, we have the data that's inside the ignition system. We didn't get a race pack read, but we do have an ignition system. So he went back to the track 10 o'clock at night, crawled up in the trailer, got the chip out of the MSD at the time, and downloaded it into his computer. And he's like, we only had an RPM graph. He's like, the RPM graph was exactly the way you drew it. Just again, years of experience, but moreover, it was the challenge that my father had instilled in me to be able to be able to microprocess as you're racing this car and give some feedback. And so in that case, it was helpful for us. They kind of maybe took it a little more to heart, or could use the data for Q3 going into Saturday, and we ended up qualifying, I think, number two in that event, and went on to finish number two in the event. So it was a fun weekend.
That is some Mr. Miyagi level of education, man. That is killer. What a story. Yeah. That is freaking cool.
Well, it's good old Jeg Senior. He is and will always be one of the best to have ever done it. And it was his tutelage that enabled that software within myself to be able to unravel something like that. And quite fun. It was, and quite honestly, it was fun and it was challenging. And it was part of that discipline conversation that we started with minutes ago. So don't typically need that type of feedback anymore. But occasionally, once in a blue moon, it's helpful.
You know, last kind of topic I want to broach with you here, I think it's fair to say, and I think anybody that has any inkling about pro stock drag racing understands that the road to the championship goes through one of your teammates. I don't think there's any denying the fact that Erica Enders is the person that is going to be and currently does lead the points, but she is the one that is going to need to be defeated to win the title. And there has to be a little bit of you that looks at her and see some of you in there, right? I mean, that is a person that I think does a lot of things that you have done over the course of your career at that level. And I guess my question to you is, how do you beat that and how do you compete with it?
Well, you just continue to raise your game without question. And it is very admirable. She's done an amazing job since coming on the scene. Junior racer, as you mentioned, and in through the likes of the Sportsman Series of NHRA and then into pro stock in the probably early to mid 2000s and to date. So, she is a true competitor and as a friend and someone I've spent a lot of time in conversation with over the years, it's been neat to see, her continue to flourish and just crush people. She's very, very focused behind the wheel and very little, gets her out of step, I would say, and that's fun to watch for a competitor like myself. And and it's as you mentioned, she'll probably be one of the front runners in the championship run this year, and no question, we feel like we're capable of running with or beyond. And but together as a team, I think it's going to be a lot of fun. We've got Troy Jr. and Aaron Stanfield and Jerry Don, the Quadra family. I mean, we have a very good group of drivers under our awnings, and the crew chiefs of which meet and the tuners of which meet every single run with the data are churning to make each and every one of our cars as efficient as they can be. And naturally we're going to bump heads a lot this year as sure. teammates, but that's just the nature of today's game.
Last point, you spent the majority of your life working inside a business that was monstrous. It was all about logistics. It was all about moving things from here to there and certainly delivering for your customers. Not too long ago, maybe a month or so ago, you got to visit the Skag Power Equipment factory, and I've never been there, but I saw the photos from your visit, and I don't know if you were as blown away as I was, but my God, it looks like they're building automobiles in there. I mean, that is an incredible, incredible operation.
It was just amazing. Since meeting Randy, one of the main owners of Skag today and in the controlling operating side of the business, listening to his story, coming in at Skag just like 14 years ago now, I believe, 12 or 14 years ago, and hearing where the company was at that point in time and seeing what it's amassed to at nearly $1.5 billion in sales. Is truly, truly enlightening. When we went through the facilities, about 10 of us from Elite were fortunate enough to go through in January, and just to see the love and the care in the environment really is why they're able to turn out equipment that is industry leading in quality and industry leading in less returns or defects. It's because they are looking at every step of their operation every single day to make it better. And I came out of there wanting to fire right back into the nice. Family business side of things, because it was just all inspiring. And I've mentioned that to Randy and much of his team every time I see him, and I mean it as truthfully and as heartfelt as I just said it. But to the point, Skag Power Equipment and all their facilities in the Mayville and the Wisconsin areas are first rate, and they're clean, they're fluid as far as the operations go. And then to learn about their automations and the way they're putting the different tractors and or pieces together for the tractors was really just neat to see firsthand. And as I said, I left there ready to go back to work. And so, yeah, quite a treat. If you ever get the chance, it's certainly an opportunity I would not turn down. And, you know, the neat thing about their involvement, not only with our team, but with the NHRA, is, you know, I think at Gainesville we had over 40 SCAG dealers that came to the event.
We could see him on the starting line, man. He had a constant flow of people coming through. It's awesome. Yeah.
Exactly. And they're not only entertaining them with our sport, but also being able to get feedback from them who are selling on the front line, selling their product. So it's really neat to, you know, we have a Saturday night get together with all the dealers and SCAG, and it's neat to hear the different stories and successes that are in the marketplace right now. And I suspect that there'll be much more to come.
Well, Jakey, it's always great to catch up with you, man. I love picking your brain about the kind of the less obvious side of drag racing, and you've been so successful. You're a fascinating guy to talk to. I wish you all the success in the world. Obviously, this year in Pro Stock is shaping up to be fantastic. We're one race in, but my expectations, as I know yours are, sky high. So, as always, thanks for taking the time, man.
Absolutely. Anytime, and appreciate it, and hope our listeners enjoyed.
We'll be right back with some final thoughts here on this episode of the NHRA Insider, powered by SCAG. Actually, powered by Speedmaster. See, you even got me in a SCAG boat now. We'll be right back after this. And we are back to close out this episode of the NHRA Insider Podcast, powered by Speedmaster. Remember, Speedmaster, a company that offers everything from replacement parts for your classic muscle car and even OEM modern cars, all the way up to pistons and hard parts for top fuel dragsters. These guys have you covered, whether it's camshafts, blocks, cylinder heads, top end kits, dress up parts. They have what you need. Ford, Chevrolet, Mopar, they got it all. Check out Speedmaster79.com to see their entire parts catalog, which is massive, and they have great availability for all of their products. No matter how hardcore you're looking, Speedmaster can handle your automotive needs. Thank you very much for watching this episode of the NHRA Insider. We're headed to the Lucas Oil NHRA Winter Nationals, the 64th running of this second most historic race on the NHRA Mission Foods Drag Racing Series Tour. Our first NHRA Mission Foods Too Fast, Too Tasty Challenge is there. Massive fields, Jasmine Salinas making her top fuel debut. A lot of great stuff on tap at the Winter Nationals, and the crowds will be big. Ticket sales are up. You need to be there at NHRA In-N-Out Pomona Drag Strip. It is coming this weekend. Go to NHRA.com to get your tickets today to be part of what promises to be an incredibly fast and, yes, another historic running of the Winter Nationals. As always, I'm Brian Loans, your host here in the NHRA Insider, powered by Speedmaster. I appreciate you hanging out, whether you're watching on the internet or listening when you're driving to work or maybe even cruising on to the Lucas Oil Winter Nationals. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back next week with a recap of the Winter Nationals and a look forward to the Arizona Nationals. We're going back to Phoenix, baby, and the place is going to be crazy. We'll see you next week.